welcome everybody to the one show that takes you where others won't. Out into the wilderness, past the frontiers of what you thought were possible. Yes, it's time for your own personal guide, the pilgrim on the 405, Mr. Will Crist.
Well, fresh back from Alaska, and some pretty cold weather up there, but wonderful experience in the villages with some great people. We're here to ask some questions, because as I walk around and talk with various leaders in business, CEOs, C-level managers, I ask them what's getting in the way of their growth, and they'll give me a number of reasons. But very often, one of the reasons is, well, if we could just get those banks to lend us more money. Somehow those banks are hanging on to all the money. Well, interestingly enough, we've been talking to a number of different banks, and some of the things that they're telling us is very interesting. They're telling us that they have lots of money, and they're trying to lend out. In fact, they have been lending a lot of money over the last year. One of those banks in particular is a unique bank in Orange County, First Foundation Bank, and the advisors that go along with them. This bank was started right at the beginning of the downturn in the economy, so they really didn't have any bad loans to get rid of. And they've had some phenomenal growth, and that's been around some of the phenomenal growth and production of the First Advisors team from First Foundation, the advisory team from First Foundation. And so we're going to interview, follow up our interview a couple of weeks ago with the president of First Foundation Bank. We're going to be speaking tonight with the president of the First Foundation Advisors, John Akopian. So John oversees the vision, the strategy, and operations and development of the investment management service for First Foundation. He's a strong entrepreneur. He focuses on results. He has exceptional interpersonal skills. And he emphasizes the people's core needs rather than the particular stock or bond portfolio that the advisory group is pushing this week or this month. Now, this has helped him to become successful both as a manager and an advisor in this very significant institution in Orange County. So I want to welcome John Akopian to the Pilgrim Talks today. John, welcome.
Thanks, and thanks for having us on.
Well, it's been a wonderful experience to hear. Now, you're one of the directors of the bank, too, right?
Yes. We started the advisory firm back in 1990 and grew that pretty rapidly over the course of 15 or 16 years, and then started the bank. I guess that got started back in 2005, but we officially didn't open the doors until 2007. So it took about 2 years.
Wonderful day, right? Wonderful time to do that, some people would say.
Yeah, you know, in hindsight, we probably, had we known what was going to happen in 2007 and 2008, we'd have probably been scared to death about opening it. But back in 2005, you know, in hindsight, the timing turned out to be perfect because we felt like it was a core competency that we needed to deliver to our clients, and we felt like there was no reason why we couldn't compete with the bigger institutions. And so that was sort of the genesis of why we decided to do what we did.
Well, and I'm glad that you did, because now tell us a little bit about the lending that you guys have been doing to businesses over the last 9 months, 12 months.
Well, we do just about all forms of lending that any big bank can do. So it could be business lending, apartment loans, variety of real estate loans, and really our competitive advantages, high touch, customized solutions, and really a single point of contact for the end client. And if they have a single service person on the banking side that they could pick up the phone and call and ask just about any need, whether it's banking, lending, depository. And then if it crosses over to the investment side, then it's a single point of contact on the investment team.
Now you guys have made some very significant volume of loans over the past 12 months to businesses, haven't you?
Yeah, we've our total loan portfolio, I think, has grown by close to, let's say, $15 to $20 million a month for the last 12 months. And so we are definitely out there lending pretty rapidly versus, compared to other, compared to what you've been reading about in the papers. A lot of the problems on the banking side has been tied with a lot of the bigger institutions, and they're the ones where there's been a reluctance on the lending side, and hopefully we're filling that hole that they're leaving behind.
Well, now when leaders of businesses hear you talking about making significant loans, before they pick up the phone and deluge your office with requests, what characterizes a good loan for you?
You know, obviously, we like skin in the game. And we, as shareholders and the founders of our institution, have a lot of skin in the game. So when we started the bank, we were the biggest shareholders. We put up the most money. And we always, that's sort of been our philosophy from day one in 1990. We wanted to be on the same side of the fence as the client. If the client did well, then we did well. If the client didn't do well, then we shouldn't, our outcome shouldn't be good. And so we used that same sort of philosophy when we got started with the bank, where we became the biggest shareholders because we put up the most money and we didn't get favored treatment on pricing of the securities. We bought in at the same exact price as all the outside shareholders did. So we like, on the lending side, we obviously want, we're looking for a typical client that can potentially use all parts of our platform, because we do feel like we have a really unique platform with strong investment skills as well as banking. And so typically it's somebody that generates good cash flow on the business side, somebody that has good assets backing the loan. And those tend to be the two core competencies, but we feel like we have a lot of strong skills on this side to evaluate a lot of stuff. And a lot of times there's things that don't fit into the black box at bigger institutions that we might be willing to do here because we're smaller, more nimble, and maybe can look at things a little bit out of the box.
And now, since you're fairly new to Orange County, people might not know that you're there, right?
Yeah, the first foundation name has only been in existence since 2007, but the investment company has actually been in Orange County since 1990. Mm-hmm. And so the investment company was formerly known as the Keller Group, and that morphed into First Foundation. So we've actually been in Orange County for over 20 years now. And on the investment side, we have well over 1,000 clients. And the banking side has been growing quite rapidly also the last 3 years. So although the name First Foundation has only been in existence for the last 3 years, the company itself has been around for over 20 years now.
Yeah. And your doors are open.
Oh, yeah. And we have multiple offices outside of Orange County now.
Mm-hmm.
So we feel like, although there's been a lot of headwinds out there, both from the economy and what you read about in the paper, we feel like we've done a good job of growing despite the headwinds, and we feel like we're pretty well positioned right now to continue to grow at a pretty nice pace.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Well, now tell me a little bit about what you see coming up in the economy. How do you see the economy? Red, green, blue?
Well, we've been saying this for the last couple of years now, where it's more of an economy that's not growing much, but it's not, at the same time, it's not falling off a cliff either. It's this slow grinding process where we don't see a lot of job growth, and so unemployment's probably going to stay pretty high on a historical basis, and we just don't see many things that would change our outlook where we're going to have accelerated growth. So we're sort of operating under the premise that the economy is going to be no different than it was a year ago. It's pretty much going to stay the same slow grinding process, and it's you know, it's our job to find investments that generate income and that are attractively priced. Thing about the investment business is you typically find your best investments during sort of this type of economy. When the economy's booming like it was back in the 90s, it's really hard to find good investments at cheap prices. This environment, although it feels doesn't feel good and the headlines don't sound great, you know, quite honestly, we're finding better investment opportunities in this environment than we would have back in 1999 when everything was mispriced and prices were expensive on everything.
And do you notice
our outlook
on
the economy is more the same slow grinding process, not a whole lot of job growth. And I don't think much is going to change, at least for the next 12 months.
Well, have you noticed that the volume of acquisitions has gone up recently?
Yeah, we've been hearing it seeing it both on the large company side. So on the large company side, the GEs, the Johnson & Johnsons, these big companies have access to money at very cheap prices today. Johnson & Johnson could do a five-year bond offering at 1%. So they have access to cheap money, which is really allowing them to do these strategic deals and go out and make acquisitions. But all the way down on the private equity side, we're also seeing more deals happen today. But they tend to be more strategic in nature than, say, 3 to 5 years ago. So, yeah, I think the deal activity, if anything, is going to pick up here the next 12 to 18 months, and it could be a lot of it starts happening overseas because in Europe there's a lot of cheap assets with the crisis they're seeing in Europe, and so you might see U.S. companies starting to buy some of those cheap assets, and conversely, the European banks are in a pretty distressed position, so they're going to be selling off assets at rock-bottom prices for the next multiple years, I think.
So I think, if anything,
you're going to see the M&A activity probably pick up over the next 12 months.
And what I'm seeing is more what you mentioned, the strategic purchases, rather than the, you know, what we had 10 years ago of a conglomerate just kind of buying anything that was producing money.
Yes. I think the buyers of the assets today, the big multinationals and, you know, the U.S.-based companies are in the best position to do the deals because, one, they have access to the capital today, where 5 or 6 years ago they were competing with other financial buyers who also had access to capital at the same rates and they were willing to bid up the prices. Today that buyer doesn't exist, or they don't exist as much as they did before. And so the Johnson & Johnson has the access to 1% money or 2% money, and they're the ones in the best position to pull off the deal today versus 5 years ago where they were getting outbid by the financial buyers.
Yeah.
So I think that trend probably continues going forward. I don't see that changing a whole lot because I think the financial buyers are having a more difficult time getting access to the capital.
Right. Right. Well, so how far down the chain does the 1% bond money go?
Typically, the bigger companies have access to that sort of capital, so it might be the 200 or 300 largest companies here in the U.S. that could issue bonds at that 1%, 2% money. The mid-sized firms and the smaller firms that rely on banks for their capital obviously don't have access to the 1% or 2% money. They got to pay 5%, 6%, or 7% to get, but that's still relatively cheap. versus where they had where rates were at 10 or 15 years ago. So the big companies have the access to the cheapest capital today, the 1% to 2% money. And it's only because there's so much fear out there and the Feds have lowered interest rates a lot, where government bonds are yielding 0.25% today. And so typically the way the bond market prices things, it's based on the risk-free rate, which is the government bond yield, and that's basically almost at zero. And so let's use Johnson & Johnson as an example. Johnson & Johnson has to pay 0.5% or 1% above the government bond rate, which today is 0 plus 0.5 or 0 plus 1. You know, the fears caused those low rates today. But we think on the investment side, there's a lot of opportunities on things that we would consider moderate risk. We don't even think they're that risky, but if you go from, there's so much fear out there that if you go from one end of the pendulum, which is the safe, low risk, no risk assets like Johnson & Johnson and barely incrementally take some risk, all of a sudden you could go from 1% to 7%. And that's where we think the opportunities are today.
Well, in the 7%?
Well, yeah, as an investment opportunity for us, mm-hmm. and even for individual investors, these are mortgage-backed securities, other types of fixed income investments that we think are moderate risk. We think, if anything, they're closer to the low-risk camp, but because there's so much fear out there that things with moderate risk or you're able to buy with a pretty big premium attached mm-hmm. to it. So we think 7-8% income streams are a great investment right now, and we don't think they're that risky. I mean, they're available everywhere.
What do you make of the announcement by the Fed today that that they were going to start discussing their rate plans in advance?
Well, I guess more transparency is better than less, and they've been trying to follow that path for the last couple years now. And they don't want people getting blindsided by uncertainty, because at some point there is going to have to be interest rates moving up, but we still think that's a couple years from happening. And so the market, what happens is, you know, if you look at the last couple of years, the market, whether it's the bond market, the stock market, any type of market, tends to overshoot way on the upside and then undershoot way on the downside. So it goes to these extremes before it settles somewhere in the middle. Mm-hmm. I think the Fed's trying to prevent some of that from happening, that if uh-huh. they sort of telegraph what the message is going to be, then maybe we don't have these extreme scenarios from happening. So I think all in all, it's probably positive. I don't know if it has much of an impact here in the short term. It probably has more of an impact when they're ready to raise interest rates. But, boy, that seems like that's so far away at this point.
Uh-huh.
That, you know, with what's happening in Europe and the unemployment rate still being pretty high here, boy, it might be another at least a minimum of 2 years before you might see any interest rate hikes.
Well, now, what... The acquisition momentum going up, that won't have much of an impact on unemployment, will it?
No, I think that's more a benefit on that. The biggest benefit there is going to be the stock market, the acquisition front.
Uh huh.
Because what typically happens is, if it is a publicly traded company, they usually pay a 20 or 30 or 40% premium to buy these companies. So that has an instantaneous impact to the price of that security. But if enough mm-hmm. of these get done and there's momentum, eventually the entire market will probably rise. So, yeah, you're right. It really doesn't have much of an influence on employment.
What do you think will have influence on employment?
I think the biggest thing is just the government. I think there's the perception of anti-business by the government today, and there's a lot of unknown factors. Where are taxes going to be? Where is the regulatory environment going to be? And people are reluctant to invest capital in that environment. And so until there's a little more certainty on what the tax front's going to look like, what the regulatory environment's going to look like, you know, I think it's going to be a while before people are willing to invest some capital. So I think the environment's got to be conducive, and right now there's a perception that the government's sort of anti-business.
Yeah.
So you need some confidence. In other words, you need confidence for people to invest their capital.
And we're probably not going to see a big change in that before the election, do you think?
Yeah, I don't see any big changes before the election. But I think you have the same government issue in Europe and Japan and a lot of different areas. So, yeah, you're right. I don't think you're going to see a whole lot of change until after the election.
That's a tough thing, isn't it? It's a tough thing how to How do you see the balance between jobs and, you know, return on capital? Or maybe the more extreme is the social fabric in support of the company, of the country, versus return on capital. How do you see that balance?
Well, I think, you know, a few years ago you probably had the extreme when there was very low regulation. Everything was pushing towards free markets, and obviously people couldn't act properly in that environment. They pushed everything to the nth degree, and you had banks failing left and right, and companies going out of business, and then now we're at the other extreme, maybe, and maybe the real area is somewhere in between, because the banks that exist today, for the most part, the WAMUs of the world are out of, the banks that were pushing the throttle no longer exist today, so mm-hmm. the remaining group probably acted, didn't push the throttle, so they survived, and now to overregulate them doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because they're the ones that played by the rules, mm-hmm. did the right thing, and now you're overregulating them. So it is a tough medium to get, which is, how much of a free market do you need versus you need some regulation, because people haven't been able to prove that they could operate in an unregulated environment, because we've had multiple situations of bad outcomes there. At the same time, you have the social element of it, and you can't go to the other extreme like we see in Europe today, where they gave out too much social benefits to their people, and now, you know, they can't, they aren't generating enough tax revenue and other things to cover some of those costs. So, yeah, there is that happy medium that needs to be found somewhere where spending equals revenues, and we've seen a lot of situations play out, from Japan's got problems because they're spending too much money. Same thing happened in Europe now, and hopefully it doesn't gravitate towards the U.S. at some point. But they're hard decisions to make. Nobody wants to cut benefits, retirement benefits. But you know, you got to, if people don't make the hard decisions, the market makes it for them, and then you end up with the Greece, Italy, Spain scenario that we're seeing play out in Europe.
Yeah,
because it's not going to go on forever where people get all these benefits and there's not enough revenue covering the benefits.
Well, you get that flight of capital too, right?
Yeah,
and then that just compounds the problem.
And the capital leaves the area forever.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now what is your take on this Europe situation? I mean, when I talk to some folks, they tell me that the whole notion of giving over your sovereignty means that you can no longer regulate I guess the word is you can't print money.
you can't print money to balance your
sovereign debt. Do you think that the euro is going to stick around?
I think it'll stick around. I'm not sure if it'll stick around in its current version or it'll be modified, because it seems like you have two really different, you've got Southern Europe that's in really bad shape, and you got Northern Europe that's in really good shape. And I don't know how the two can stay married to one another, because Southern Europe's standard of living has to drop significantly. They don't produce enough goods there. They're providing these incredible benefits to their people that there's no way they could continue to provide those benefits. So what happens is now, you know, as the crisis has played out, they implement these austerity programs in these countries, and all of a sudden you're raising taxes, cutting spending, which actually makes the situation worse in the short term. And they have a demographic problem out in Southern Europe, too, where there's not enough young people in the workforce to support the retired people. And when you look at some of the demographics over the last 20 years out there, you had, you know, 20 years ago, you had maybe seven workers supporting one retired person. When you look at the numbers today, it's down to like three supporting one, and in 10 years, it's going to be down to 1.5 supporting one. It's a tough predicament, and it just seems like there's got to be something that gets modified out there, and maybe the euro, maybe there's a southern euro and a northern euro, because I think the biggest problem southern Europe has is they don't have a mechanism to devalue their currency.
Yeah.
So in other words, if their euro was at 1-to-1 or less than, you know, 1 to the dollar, then all of a sudden that might help them so that they could export.
Yeah.
That's a big problem that they're having. It's sort of like, if you remember back in 19, we think of it as the Asian crisis in reverse. So in 1998, when Asia and South Korea went through the same predicament, they grew out of their problem because the first thing they did was devalue their currency by 50%.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, they spent the next 7 years growing and paying down their debt, and here we are 15 years later, and Asia's in the best situation because they have very little debt, and they created a manufacturing base and other things in their economy, and now they're sitting in the catbird seat.
By devaluing, that's another word for printing more money, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm getting a lot of different takes on that process, especially in the political climate right now. I want to talk to you more about that after we get back from the break. Can you stick around with us?
Sure, absolutely.
All right. Well, let's hear from our friends over at Sandler Training.
Hi, I'm Mike Crandall with Sandler Training, here to talk to you about Sandler Rule number 3, no mutual mystification. So what does it mean? Well, let me ask, have you ever entered into a sales call with an expectation that it was going to end one way, and then to find out that it did not end that way, but another way, bad or good? Or have you ever been in a meeting with an expectation of what was going to transpire, only to find out that that isn't actually what transpired? Both of those are examples of where there was mutual mystification. In general, you can think of mutual mystification as any time when two parties have different expectations and don't take the time to clarify them in advance of the interaction. It's our job as sales professionals to be intentional about finding out what expectations people have, to define phrases and terms in advance that might be misunderstood, to tie up any loose ends. Also to make sure that all parties are in sync with what has happened as well as what will happen. I like to say this is summed up by one of my favorite phrases. The source of all the world's frustration is unfulfilled expectation.
And now back to Will and his guest.
Well, we've been talking with John Hakopian, the president of First Foundation Advisors and one of the directors of a very successful bank, First Foundation Bank, here in Orange County. So, John, tell me a little bit. I mean, as an investment person, you're a little bit, you got arm's length at least from political activity. Tell me a little bit about how you see all this conversation about, you know, Governor Perry of Texas saying, well, if those guys printing more money come down here, we'll take, you know, we're not going to treat them very nicely. But isn't printing more money part of the way out of our dilemma right now?
No, that's a good point. And, yeah, the government is definitely trying to reflate their way out of our predicament here. And you know, that's happening globally also in just about every country where nobody wants their currency to appreciate. They want it, you know, they want to reflate. And from an investment perspective, you know, what we try to, it's very difficult to predict, you know, what goes on a macro scale, especially whether, you know, we're going to have the printing of money or what the government is going to do strategically, and we try to spend a lot of our time on the specific investment decisions. So right now, for example, well, U.S. corporations are in great financial shape. Most of them have no debt. They're sitting on billions of dollars in cash in the bank. So the governments are in terrible shape, but the corporations are in great shape. And oddly enough, today, you could buy these big companies that typically have traded at premium prices. Today, you could buy them at rock bottom prices, and they're paying you 3 or 4% dividends, and their dividends are going up every year, so you have an inflation hedge. So if there is inflation coming down the pike, but you have these companies raising their dividends, and they could raise their prices, and you're buying them at cheap prices today, and they have terrific financial strength. So we think from an investment perspective, there's a lot of investments out there that can protect you from the inflation side of things, and you're getting paid while you wait. Plus, we think you're buying them at low prices where the prices can also rise. And so, you know, it's very difficult to navigate what's going on the macro side because there are so many different factors at play here, whether it's Europe, whether it's election here in the U.S., and it's very difficult to navigate a lot of that stuff. And so what we can control is, are we buying an investment at a good price or not? And we try to spend a lot of our time on that. And whether it's, you know, looking at U.S. blue chips or looking at real estate or looking at corporate bonds, high-yield bonds, mortgage-backed securities, we feel like there's a lot of opportunities out there today that we're buying at close to bargain basement prices. We're getting paid while we wait. Plus, we think if we get appreciation. So we think the three factors all sort of line up. But what's happened over the last couple of years, Will, is you have periods where everybody gets too optimistic and they run up prices. And then these are like 3 to 6 month periods. They're not even 3 to 5 year periods. They're like short periods where it seems like everything's going well. This happened last year when last November when we had sort of the election results and then the Bush tax cuts got extended for another couple of years, and all of a sudden the stock market takes off, all the risk assets take off, and then 5 months later Europe implodes and all the risk assets go down in conjunction. And so you have to be disciplined with your price, and you got to stay on the sidelines when prices are too expensive and wait. Let the price come to you and wait for those periods when prices get cheap, and that's when you step in and buy some of the risk assets.
So what I'm hearing, John, is that while this might not be the best of times for an investment banker, this is not the worst of times.
No, and, you know, there's an old adage, the best loans are usually made during the worst of times. Just don't know it at that time. The same could be said. The best investments are also made during the worst of times. And today you have a situation that's almost the polar opposite of 1999. Remember, in 1999, you had a perfect macro environment. You had unemployment at 3.5%, job market booming, U.S. economy booming, global economy booming. But 5 or 10 years later, your investment results were terrible because prices were expensive in 1999. And even though the macro environment is perfect, everybody had to pay high prices, whether it was for real estate or stocks, bonds, whatever it is. Today, you have the exact opposite. You have the macro environment that's terrible. Europe's terrible. Japan's terrible. Everything up here at the 10,000-foot level looks terrible, but then when you look down at the actual investments, the prices are actually pretty attractive today. And so you never have a scenario where the macro environment's perfect and the prices are cheap. That never happens, not in our world. And so you have to be willing to step in and buy when these prices are cheap, and that usually happens when the macro environment's pretty bad. And then conversely, you got to be willing to sell when the macro environment gets better, because that's usually when the herd comes in and runs everything up. And that's a tough discipline to implement. Even for us, it's tough because you're buying in the face of bad news. And unfortunately, it sounds simple, buy low, sell high, but I'm here to tell you, after doing this for 23 years, it's the single hardest thing to do, because usually when you're selling high, that means the news is perfect, everything's great, everybody's making money on their house, everybody's making money in the stock market, and you don't want to be the odd man sitting on the sidelines.
Yeah.
And then the flip side is, you, when you buy low, that's usually when people are scared to invest any money.
But it you know, the one thing that concerns me, and I know it, investment has very little to do with it, but the one thing that does concern me is cracking this unemployment, because that really does have a day-to-day effect on lots of people.
No, it does, and you know, that's consumer confidence and a lot of other things that play out. That's the one thing that could help the housing market. If the job market improves and people are more confident, they'll go out and buy houses. That's the single biggest thing that helps the economy. And today it's hard to see how that can change unless, you know, if there's some technological innovation that we can't foresee right now, like in the 90s when you had cable TV, the cell phone, the internet, all these technological advances that took place that drove the job market. I thought, you know, 4 years ago, that the one area that could drive the job market would have been if there was some cohesive energy policy. But that doesn't seem like
it's
going to happen anytime soon, because, you know, at our presentation, Boone Pickens was talking about natural gas, and I keep on reading about natural gas as a way to lower the dependence on the Middle East and the oil there, because we have plenty of natural gas here in the U.S. that can create high-paying jobs, that could lower the dependence on oil from overseas. And it seems like it's a no-brainer, but for some reason it's not happening.
Well, now that you've had a chance to digest what he said at that presentation, do you think it was a lot of just a lot of hope on his part? I mean, he did say we're going to get a chance to talk about energy plan in the next month. Did you get any clarity on what that meant?
Yeah, I don't think anything's going to happen until there's a change in the, you know, unless there's a change in the government on the next, you know, on this upcoming November, because you really need somebody to drive this policy. You need the leadership and. And it seems like it could get done, but you need somebody to push the process, and it doesn't seem like the current administration really embraces natural gas and the drilling that needs to take place. And they seem like, when you look at where they're placing their energy bets, it's been more on, you know, the solar and some of the other alternative parts, with alternative areas, which are really 20 to 30 years out, and versus the natural gas that's available today. So I'm not that optimistic on the next 12 months, but I am optimistic maybe over the next 5 years, that if you had another administration that really embraced this idea, that you know, you could see some pretty significant changes. And I think you could get job creation at the same time too. If you look at a lot of the areas that have the natural gas, their actual job creation has been pretty strong, whether it's Ohio, Pennsylvania, and some of the states.
I noticed that Ohio was claiming they had a little earthquake because of the gas and oil drilling over there. That's a hard stretch, but growing up in Texas, we didn't have a whole lot of earthquakes, and there's a lot of drilling there.
I think there's an opportunity there, and certainly there's a lot of stuff going on the technology side in the U.S. that has been pushing things on the non-energy and the non-energy areas, whether it's you know, the whole drive towards wireless. But I do think you could have a really big multi-year. And then I think the other thing that could help the job market is people – and businesses and manufacturing is so portable today that if you could lower, you know, there's been a lot talked about lowering the corporate tax rate, because a lot of these companies are manufacturing in other areas where tax rates are a lot cheaper. And if you got them a little more equalized, I think a lot of that stuff might stay in the U.S. versus going overseas. Because I don't think most U.S. manufacturers, they aren't going to, they'd rather manufacture here, but the tax differential is so significant in some cases. So if you could, you don't have to get to parity, but if you could get it closer where there isn't that big of a disadvantage, and I think a lot of that stuff might stay here in the U.S. because, you know, let's face it, there's a lot of manufacturing done overseas, and then all that cash is held in overseas banks, and most U.S. companies would rather hold that cash in the U.S. So the repatriation that we've heard about a lot, that doesn't seem like it's gained any momentum, but that's another way of at least putting in some incentives that maybe the jobs stay here in the U.S., and I think it's important that some of that manufacturing happens in the U.S. versus all going overseas.
Now, I noticed that there's a lot of biomedical manufacturing that's coming back on shore, especially here in Orange County. I mean, that's where I see it. Are you seeing much activity in that sector in the bank?
No, we haven't seen much of that on the bank side. We really haven't. I think a lot of what we've seen on the bank side has been, the first 2 years was a lot of it was real estate oriented, and in the last probably 12 to 18 months, it's been more small businesses that the B of A's of the world, you know, have decided not to service anymore, and so we're starting to see some of that come through the pike. And I think there's sort of that pendulum swing in our way now, where there, you know, back during the crisis, there seemed to be a really aversion, or probably people wanted to hold their money at the big banks because they felt like the banks were financially stronger, the government wouldn't allow them to fail. Too big to fail, but now there's been such negative sentiment towards the bigger banks that people are more open to working with a smaller bank that maybe doesn't have the name recognition that the bigger bank has. So that pendulum's sort of swinging back our way now. And I do think, the you know, there's something to be said for that. And I think another thing that the government could do is if the government put in some incentives that would help smaller banks, then maybe, you know, that can drive the growth in the smaller banks, because right now most of the deposits are sitting in the bigger institutions.
And the bigger institutions,
I think that's another
thing
the government
not loaning,
do, separate from helping the energy area, but helping smaller banks.
And you know, I've had a lot of conversations with some of my clients about community banks, particularly companies that are looking to acquire community banks, and that does seem to be the real heart of business growth. Seems to me to have a lot to do with the strength and the willingness of community banks to loan.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Community banks have been the primary lender to small businesses, but so many community banks out there today are kind of stagnant and have had a difficult time growing because they might have had some bad loans on their books, and now the government's really over-regulating them, and their costs are going up, and all of a sudden they're having a tough time making money out there. And so we kind of think there's going to be some consolidation on the community bank side because so many of them were having a difficult time growing. We haven't been, so we do think, you know, potentially we could be the acquirer of some of these smaller institutions. But you're right. If you look at the last 3 to 5 years, versus historically, the community banks usually dominated the smaller business lending. And if we can get back to that again, and maybe the government needs to put some incentives out there to help on that front and really drive community, because quite frankly, there's been virtually no startup community banks probably since we got started back in 07. So there's no new ones coming online because it's virtually impossible to start a new bank today. And then the existing ones a lot of them had some problems with loans and other things, and so their cost structure's gone up, regulation's gone up, and it's been pretty tough for them to grow. So if there's a way to reinvigorate community banking, I think that'd be a huge plus for job growth, small business growth, and everything else.
Well, some of that's going on with recapitalizing banks, and at the and part of the price of recapitalizing is to make them more efficient.
Yes.
Put some controls in that and do the kind of training that those big banks used to be doing, and do the training, and maybe with the community banks having some sort of relationships with other community banks and not seeing them all as hyper competitive institutions.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And it is, it was easy for the big banks to get recapitalized.
well, you and I did it, right?
Stepped in and gave them money.
Right.
But it's much more difficult to recapitalize the smaller banks. We got started, again, our timing was good here, but we put up a lot of our own money to capitalize our bank. And so a lot of the smaller banks are having difficulty getting recapitalized, and that's one of the reasons they haven't been able to grow, is because they don't have the capital. The regulators have been very difficult on them. They don't want them to grow until they get recapitalized, and they can't get recapitalized. And as a result, I think the best option for some of these guys is to partner with another community bank or merge into another community bank if they can't get recapitalized.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they're not really serving their function.
Yeah, I think that's part of the part of the change that's there. I mean, 10 years ago, community banks seemed to me to be akin to, there's a bunch of cowboys out there who wanted to have their name at the top of the list in terms of banks, and it was also seen as an easy way to get a good return on your investment.
Yes.
And I think that whole ego thing about that is still around for many people. And if you stood back and took a look at it and said, well, how are we going to make the community bank system work? There's a lot of ways to make it work a lot better, but it would have to address some of that leftover ego that's around in some of the institutions.
Well, I always say the easiest thing to do is, right now, it's almost impossible to start one of these institutions. But two, if some of these guys had more skin in the game, maybe they wouldn't have been out there acting like cowboys. And when we started our institution, several of us had 50 or 60% of our net worth in this place. And so, you act a lot differently when you have skin in the game than when you're just handed stock options.
Yeah.
Where it's a one-way, incentive structure. You either hit it, you hit it big, or you don't hit it and you don't lose any money because you've never put up the money but the stock options. That was the incentive structure that seemed to be pervasive out there. But, I do think today it's much more difficult. Back 10 years ago, you could start a bank with $10 to $15 million of capital. That's virtually impossible today. You need 50
right.
or 100 million to get started.
Well, I've seen a lot of used cubicle walls decorated with expired stock options.
That's right. And you're right. If you looked at the numbers as of 2005, virtually 95 or 98, I remember seeing some of the statistics when we were looking at getting started. I think 98% of all banks that got formed in the 20 years ending 2005 were success stories, huge returns to investors. And when you have that happening, it attracts a lot of new capital, and that's what happened. And the new capital came in. It wasn't as the capital wasn't as smart as the prior capital. But today, now you have the opposite scenario, where if you can get into the industry today, the returns are probably a lot higher.
Yeah. It's amazing. Well, you guys have seemed to have done some very, very good things in terms of discipline and focus on what your core values are. I mean, I know talking to you, and to, you know, the rest of the team, you guys are pretty clear about who you're serving. And it's not yourself. And I don't take that lightly. I mean, it's, you know, Rick and Scott consistently talk about the focus on customers. In fact, that was one of the reasons they didn't want to sell the, you know, the Keller investment to some of those big banks that wanted to buy them, because they would lose control of the quality of the service to the customers. And I hear the same thing in your voice. I mean, the discipline of investing for the customer. And that's what I've heard you for the last 50 minutes talk about. And I got to applaud that, John.
No, thanks, Will. And that's been our philosophy from day one, is do what's best for the client, align our interests with our clients, and everything else will sort of take care of itself if we could do those first two things right. Mm-hmm. And we never thought 20 years ago we'd be in this situation that we're in today. But it was a simple philosophy back in 1990 that we didn't feel like the Merrill, you know, the big brokerage firms of the world had the proper structure in place, and we felt our structure made more sense because it was aligned with the client, it did what the client wanted, and so the rest of the industry sort of gravitated towards where we're at. And then we felt the same way when we got started with the bank, that if we could deliver that same commitment, high level of service, that the rest would take care of itself. And you're right, I don't think any of us have worked for a big institution, so we have no aspirations of ever selling out.
And in a sense, selling out would be selling out your customers in that long, hard work of developing those customer relationships so carefully. Well, John, thank you very much. This has been a lot of fun talking to you, and I think there's a lot of good insights there. If somebody wanted to continue that conversation with you about investment, maybe even talking about the possibility of getting a loan, who would they talk to? Should they call you? Should they call somebody else?
Yeah, no, they could feel free to give me a call, and I could point them in the right direction, whether it's a banking or an investment client.
And how would they do that?
And our number here is 949-476-0300.
What was that
and
again?
We're located in Irvine, but we actually have offices in Palm Desert, and La Jolla, and Pasadena, and soon to be in West L.A.
So now tell me why that's so hard for you to remember where all those offices are.
Well, they've all sort of opened in the last 12 to 15 months.
That's right. You guys are growing.
Yeah, and we felt like all those areas, we already had a client base, so it wasn't like we were starting from scratch. We had existing clients in a lot of those areas, and then we were able to, with the crisis in the financial services industry, we were able to hire top-notch talent out of all these bigger institutions. And so we know we got to get those two. We're not going to start an office unless we have top-notch talent that's operated in that area. And so as soon as we were able to hire 2, 3, or 4 people, then we feel a little more comfortable in starting something out there.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you so much for spending the time with us, John. This has been very enlightening, and it's so good to hear success in one of our Orange County institutions.
Well, thanks for having me on, and really enjoyed the hour with you, Will.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Take care. We've had a great conversation with John Hakopian, the president of First Foundation Advisors and one of the directors of the First Foundation Bank, one of those institutions that got started up at, you know, if you're looking back on it, maybe the wrong time, but it became the right time. Lots of things that Rick Keller and Scott Cavanaugh and John Hakopian did that could have turned bad, but turned very, very right. And especially what I picked up in talking with all extensively is their focus on the customer. What is good for the customer? What's best for our customer base? And how do we serve them better? And that's how the bank got started, was to continue that discipline study, that discipline path of putting the customer first and creating the support team to help that customer thrive and to make the best choices for that customer. Wonderful to hear that we have that in Orange County. Well, there you have it from Pilgrim on the 405. Look forward to talking with you next week when we have some more interesting people, CEOs of thriving companies in Orange County.
You've been listening to the only show that takes you where others won't. Out into the wilderness, past the frontier of what you thought was possible. Taking a look at the new sales techniques and technologies transforming the world of sales today.